I.org online, and what do you know? It is now 1 p.m. All right, let's start this show.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. In his latest book, Solving the Climate Crisis, Frontline Reports from the Race to Save the Earth, journalist and environmental science and policy specialist John J. Berger offers practical actions that reflect technological and economic advances. It's published by Seven Stories Press and brings John J. Berger to our show now. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Leonard. It's a pleasure to be here.
There's a quote from Martin Luther King Jr. at the front of your book. Tomorrow is today. We are confronted with the fierce urgency of now. So how urgent and fierce is it?
It's pretty urgent and it's pretty fierce. There is a climate time bomb ticking in the background, even as we talk and have a pleasant conversation about climate solutions. This is a risk that we have chosen to take. And nationally, we are the world's largest producer of oil and natural gas and the largest consumer of both and the third largest producer of coal. So our foot is pushed pedal to the metal on the fossil fuel accelerator. And we are hurtling towards a climate cliff, but we're driving in the dark because we don't know precisely where that cliff is. But we do know that we have already severely disrupted the climate. And according to the Potsdam Institute, we're looking by 2050 at $38 trillion in global damages as a result of our fossil fuel addiction.
You begin your book with the story of Dale Ross, the former mayor of Georgetown, Texas, who's a self-described fiscal conservative. So how political is this crisis?
Well, unfortunately, the crisis has been heavily politicized, but it's not really a political issue intrinsically. Because when a hurricane or a flood comes, it doesn't tap on your door before flooding you or blowing your roof off and asking for your political affiliation. It just, you know, does the damage that it's going to do. These are scientific issues, and they have to do with the functioning of the climate. So you can have all kinds of political objections. But the climate system only responds to the concentration of global warming gases that are in the atmosphere. And if we put more and more climate disturbing gases in the atmosphere, the climate is inexorably going to get more and more disturbed, and natural systems will be more and more on the precipice of tipping to positive climate feedbacks, which means that they begin to release greenhouse gases spontaneously, and that can get to the point where no human action can intercede and countervail this flood of greenhouse gases coming from burning forests or from thawing Arctic tundra, where more than a trillion tons of carbon dioxide and methane are locked, frozen now. But they are beginning to thaw and emerge from their thousands of years of dormancy.
What happened with Dale Ross? He switched positions over the years?
Not as far as I know. I think he's just been pro clean energy because clean energy saves money, and that's why Texas now gets more energy from wind, more of its electricity from wind and solar than from natural gas. It's not for love of, quote, green power, but Dale Ross looked at the balance sheet and he saw that he could get a long-term fixed price contract for power from a solar power plant versus the fluctuating price of natural gas. And as an accountant by training, he liked that price stability.
And that was a local issue, although Texas is a big state. Hasn't Donald Trump had an impact on federal policies?
When Donald Trump was president, he tried to undo as many environmental policies as possible.
And made fun of windmills, for example.
He had all kinds of very bizarre theories about windmills and the noise and alleged cancer and so forth. And Donald Trump pulled us out of the global Paris Climate Agreement of 2015. As soon as President Biden was elected, he rejoined the Paris Climate Agreement, which puts us in line with other nations of the world in trying to get a grip on the continuing rise of global greenhouse gas emissions.
Now, that agreement was at the UN, right? So there's a global concern about the situation. It's not just this country, although aren't we one of the worst offenders?
We are, Leonard. And just to clarify, it was a UN-sponsored conference that took place in Paris, but not at the UN itself. And we are certainly, as I mentioned at the outset, responsible for releasing a tremendous amount of greenhouse gas. We produce about 14% of the global greenhouse gas emissions. China, I believe, is at something like 26 or 28%. Hmm. And other nations like India and Russia are next in line. We could do a great deal more. People often use the fact that China produces twice as much greenhouse gas as we do as an excuse for inaction. But in reality, we all breathe the same global atmosphere. And if we do not fix this problem, every nation on Earth is going to suffer, just as every Democrat and Republican will suffer. So this is an issue that we need to assume a much stronger global leadership role on. And if the United States were to take full advantage of all the technology that we have available now, which is cost effective and scalable and proven and implemented it using our tremendous financial strength and our technological innovation and ingenuity, we could be a model for the rest of the world, then we would be in a much stronger position to morally exhort other countries to follow our good example. We're in a very conflicted position right now, being the world's largest oil and gas producer and earning revenue from that and exporting these fuels, and then at the same time telling people that we are pursuing a reasonable climate policy and that by 2050 we're going to become net zero. We could do this a great deal sooner. Nobody knows exactly how much sooner, but a great deal sooner, because we are spending just a pittance of what we should be spending and could be spending to accelerate the green energy transition.
Well, it's led to rifts within the Democratic Party. Senator Manchin is now an independent because he's been a defender of oil and gas, coal?
He still is a defender of oil and gas and coal. Many people don't realize that the Inflation Reduction Act is actually the embodiment of a self-contradictory energy policy called all of the above, in which you boost coal and oil and natural gas and renewable energy. That's not a climate policy. That's a policy that is designed to slow walk the clean energy transition. It was because Joe Manchin's vote was necessary in the Senate that the Inflation Reduction Act was modified so that it fast tracks a natural gas pipeline, it fast tracks oil leasing, and it provides billions of dollars for technologically foolish and counterproductive investments in carbon capture and storage. What you see there, I can go into that in more detail if you want.
Please.
But should I?
Yes,
should
that's why we've invited you, because you know these things and you've been studying them for, what, how many years now in preparation for this? You've also written three books on climate change.
Yeah, well, I've been working in the energy field since the 1970s, on and off, and I've studied these issues intensively. What happens in terms of capturing carbon from the atmosphere using technologies known as direct air capture? You use a lot of energy in order to capture the carbon, and maybe 60% of that energy, depending on the grid, comes from burning more fossil fuel. So you're kind of on a treadmill from the get-go. Now, in theory, all of these direct air capture machines could indeed be operated on clean power. But if you did that and you built clean power capacity to do that, then instead of replacing coal burning and natural gas burning plants, which are spewing out fossil fuel pollution, you would be using it for direct air capture. Then the critical point is, what happens with that captured CO2? Well, there's no real commercial market for it. We have adequate sources of CO2 right now. So the idea behind these schemes, and they use that word pretty intentionally, is to take that and that CO2 and use it for enhanced oil recovery. So for every ton of CO2 that's used, you would produce 2 barrels of oil, which when burned would produce 9/10 of a ton of CO2. And then, moreover, 40% of that CO2 that's injected into the oil-bearing formation is going to ultimately be released. So this is a technology that sets us back, and it's used as a way of creating a smoke screen, if you will, for perpetuating our reliance on coal and natural gas.
When you say smoke screen, I know you're not really thinking in terms of puns, but is it having an impact on, smog and things like that?
I'm not sure what the predicate of the question is, the it. Are you referring to specifically these projects, which you were just discussing?
Yes.
Of course. Every time you burn fossil fuel, you create air pollution. And globally, 7.5 to 8 million people a year are dying from air pollution, 90% of which is caused by fossil fuel. Plus, there are hundreds of millions of people that are sickened by exposure to air pollution. So this is trillions of dollars, if you want to translate it into dollars and cents, of damages created by the fossil fuel industry. So yes, smog is one byproduct, but it's the least of it in a sense. There are all kinds of other damages to air and water and to human life, to the environment. And as a result of climate change, we are seeing an increase in the rate of extinctions. We are already facing a tremendous drop in the abundance of all vertebrate species, probably in the last 30 or 40 years.
We'll be discussing that later this week on another show, but continue. So we're killing off other animal species. I assume we're killing ourselves off as well.
Well, in terms of the air pollution, yes. And in terms of the damages from heat waves take human lives, so do hurricanes, so do floods. We are killing ourselves, and it's going to get worse to the extent that we continue to increase our releases of climate-disturbing gases to the atmosphere as a result of burning fossil fuels. We do not need to do this. What I show in my book is that we have all the technology that we need. Maybe 5% of the technology needs to be evolved a little faster, but we could go full speed ahead right now and convert every single sector of the economy to reliance on clean energy from solar, from wind, geothermal, hydro, ultimately from some wave power and from energy storage, which has now become extremely cheap relative to the price it was even 10 years ago. It's fallen by 90%, and the costs are going to fall even further.
My guest on today's Leonard Lopate at Large is John J. Berger. His latest book, Solving the Climate Crisis, Frontline Reports from the Race to Save the Earth, published by Seven Stories Press. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming live at WBAI.org. We never really resolved an earlier thing that came up that what you just said reminds me of. How much of this has to be dealt with on a federal level and how much on state and then local levels?
There are policies that definitely require federal guidance. This whole transition is far, far too important to be left to a hodgepodge of local and state regulations. We should have a national clean energy transition plan that would guide the clean transition on the most efficient, most cost-effective track with the least environmental damage. We should be putting all of our national laboratories and the National Academy of Sciences to work by order of Congress to produce a national clean energy transition plan. I would call it a national climate prosperity plan because it would have tremendous economic benefits and it would unlock trillions of dollars in energy savings and create millions of good paying new jobs. And it would literally save millions of lives and species. And it would also protect public health at the same time as protecting the environment. So we need to do this on the federal level in terms of coherent national planning. We also need a national climate emergency declaration so that the entire country mobilizes to address this issue and accord it the extreme urgent priority that it requires. It is much more important than all kinds of things that we're lavishing hundreds of billions of, if not trillions of dollars on. So we need this federal guidance and we need a national mobilization. We also need a national, what's called renewable energy requirement. The technical term is a national portfolio standard that would set specific goals under a national clean energy plan for the transition of each sector of the economy and set milestones and timetables and evaluation protocols so that we would do this in an organized and efficient, cost-effective manner. We have to also provide adequate federal support for natural carbon solutions, including carbon farming and carbon ranching and reforestation. Taken in the aggregate, these natural climate solutions can remove billions of tons of CO2 from the atmosphere so that once we get to the state of net zero carbon emissions, we need to ramp up everything possible to pull excess carbon out of the atmosphere so that we return the CO2 concentration of climate disturbing gases back to the pre-industrial level so that the climate will re-equilibrate and begin to cool down. We know from the science that once we get to zero net CO2 emissions, we will begin to see within 2 or 3 years a cooling of the climate because natural climate sinks, namely the ocean, but also to some extent forests and vegetation, will be removing sufficient carbon from the atmosphere to lower the global temperature. Now, it's not going to happen overnight, but at least we will stop increasing global temperature and gradually we will tamp down the flames of climate change that are raging right now.
So you talk about cutting down on the proliferation of greenhouse gases, for example. Are there proposals for ways that we can enhance and protect natural ecosystems, forests, agricultural lands, to safely store greenhouse gases and restore soils and transform how we grow, process, and consume food?
Absolutely. That's something that I cover in Solving the Climate Crisis. For example,
but that's why I brought it up.
I describe the work of rancher John Wick, who has found that by spreading a thin dusting of ordinary compost on ranch land, you can jumpstart the soil ecosystem so that it becomes healthier and begins to capture more carbon from the atmosphere. Gabe Brown, a farmer and rancher in North Dakota, found the same thing in his ranching activities, where he used regenerative agricultural practices like keeping cover crops in the ground and using no-till agriculture, not using fertilizers or herbicides, and not using tillage, but using natural grazing and the manure of animals to fertilize the land. He was able to increase yields because he improved the health of the soil. And soil health is fundamental to the health of the agricultural economy. And if you improve soil health by protecting the soil, incorporating more green matter into the soil begins to rev itself up, because carbon is sort of the fuel for the soil ecosystem. And then more carbon is captured from the atmosphere. And then the soil itself produces healthier plants, which perpetuate that cycle of additional carbon and nitrogen storage. So you can store nitrogen from the air and avoid having to pay money for nitrogen storage. I mean, for artificial nitrogen fertilizer.
So do we save money or lose money, or, I mean, spend more money in changing the way we do things?
Well, ultimately, we save a great deal of money. The money that we invest in the clean transition typically pays for itself 3 to 7 times or 3 to 5 times over. So it's definitely a stimulus to the economy. It makes the economy a great deal more competitive globally. And there's every reason to do it for the public health, environmental, and energy savings benefits. But we save money on energy. Right now, we're spending $1 trillion a year buying and burning fossil fuels. If we electrify our economy and the economy becomes a great deal more efficient, we'll save hundreds of billions of dollars right off the bat. We can also stop subsidizing the fossil fuel industry, by the way, and that's another whole discussion. But
we'll
if the question
that.
Is it economically beneficial to invest in a rapid clean energy transition, the answer is unquestionably so.
But where will that money to protect the climate come from? Are we talking about private sources? Because I don't hear any mention of major government programs.
Well, we have some major government programs, and even though the Inflation Reduction Act and the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act are badly flawed, they are still having a multiplier effect on the economy and are still jump-starting a great deal of activity, new battery factories, new electric vehicle factories, new solar power plants through their tax credits. But if you look analytically at what the Inflation Reduction Act is actually providing for those activities that mitigate greenhouse gases, you'll find that out of the $37 billion a year for 10 years that are provided in the program, maybe only $27 billion or something go to real mitigation, because about 40% go for ideas like carbon capture from the atmosphere, which we talked about earlier and which doesn't make any sense. And so even with this relatively small amount of money, we're still getting a lot of value. We could use things like green bonds, for example, and we could raise hundreds of billions of dollars profitably that could be lent out, and the returns would earn money for the taxpayer right on the face of it, and in addition would stimulate tremendous economic activity in the clean sector. So this is a no-brainer. We should also be much more heavily funding a clean energy bank. About $20 billion have been accorded for that purpose already. So I think we should be doing this to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars a year. I think with a $26, $27 trillion economy, 2% of that would be $500 billion a year. We would not miss it if we tweaked our Internal Revenue Service collection of unpaid taxes by wealthy people. We could come up with that amount of money, or if we had a tiny wealth tax on people who make more than $100 million a year. It's not hard for us to come up with money when we need it. We came up with trillions of dollars to address COVID and to address the 2007 recession. Climate change is a great deal more important to the United States and to the world, even than an economic recession or a downturn.
Because it's longer lasting.
It will produce damage of an existential nature that will throw our civilization into chaos and cause hundreds of millions, if not billions, of people to become refugees. We are now on track to create global average temperatures that will result in heat waves in a significant portion of the world, so that about 1 to 1.5 billion people by 2070 will be exposed to intolerably hot temperatures for a portion of every year. And when that occurs, a lot of folks don't have the benefits of air conditioning, and people will be dying as a result of these excess temperatures. It is in our power to avoid that kind of a future, but we have to act now, and we have to prioritize this as the existential crisis that it is. And by penny pinching and spending money on the wrong kinds of energy and the wrong kinds of technology now, it is totally counterproductive. As I said, we're spending $1 trillion on fossil fuels. We need to get to the point where that money is available increasingly for the rapid installation and transformation of our industrial sector, our housing sector, transportation, agricultural sector, and forestry. And I don't think I completely answered your question about forests and agriculture. I addressed agriculture and soils. We can definitely replant and restore a lot of damaged forests and wetlands, which naturally store carbon from the atmosphere and lock it in reservoirs in the soil, where it will remain safely for a long period of time.
So farmers would have to adjust, right? How much adjusting has there been? For example, we've talked about switching to solar and wind technologies, but I don't see a lot of public reaction to that. Some people do, but the great majority of people are just going along with the way things are, no?
I think that that's not unusual, because we have become detached from nature, and we think that electricity comes from a socket in the wall and that food comes from Safeway. And we forget that I think it was Herman Daly, the ecologist and economist, who said that the economy is a wholly owned subsidiary of the environment. So if we don't take care of the environment and protect it, then we will not have these natural services from the environment. Everything that we take for granted now, including the price of food and the availability of water, will become more expensive and more scarce. Much of the world is already suffering from water scarcity. And as a result of climate change, droughts are becoming much more severe and much more frequent. And this is devastating, and it's one of the drivers of the migration that we even experience on our southern border, and that's being experienced throughout Africa and the Middle East.
And then we have, on top of droughts, we have flooding.
So yes.
Is that the other side of that story? Or
it
is
absolutely
totally
the other. What climate science shows us is that as a result of disrupting the climate, we cause rainfall to be less frequent but more intense. And during those less frequent periods, we have droughts. So it's totally a function of climate science, and it was all predicted 50 years ago. So we had ample warning of this even back in the 1960s. President Johnson received a report that outlined all of these dangers, but the public has not really been tuned into it, and there's been a disinformation campaign that was funded by hundreds of millions of dollars from the fossil fuel industry and its allies, which has befuddled the public and confused the issue and set us back decades in addressing the issue. People were led to believe that climate change was good, that CO2 was good, that a little warming wouldn't hurt us, and that there was a whole succession of myths that changed as each myth became palpably incredible to the public. At first, the climate wasn't changing. Then it was changing just a little bit. Oh, if it's changing a little bit, but the little bit would be good for us. And then maybe it wasn't changing just a little. Maybe it was changing a bit more, but we can adapt to it, and we're getting more benefits than costs. But now it's very clear that the costs of pursuing this path are horrific, and the consequences are lethal and mortal and threatening our civilization. So there's no question that we have to get the public on board with this. And one way I think we should do this is, I believe that we ought to have, just as we have a national State of the Union address, I think the president ought to give a national State of the Climate address and make people aware of what's happening on a year-by-year basis, and focus attention on the kind of progress that we're making towards making this country basically a net zero carbon economy. I also think that we should support a national atlas of climate risk so that people in the United States can visualize and communicate about the climate risks that are within our borders, so people would see in terms of an interactive map the current areas of climate threat and future risk, so that you wouldn't be so blasé if you knew that in 10 years your property was likely to be flooding 5 times a year, or that your farmland is going to be drying out, and so forth. And so I think that we need to make people more aware. I also think that we should use the Federal Defense Production Act to produce millions of solar panels, heat pumps, wind turbines, and charging stations to basically supercharge the clean energy transition in this country, just as we supercharged the mobilization of the nation at the start of World War II, when we were basically demilitarized, and then we became the world's preeminent military power. To become the world's preeminent clean energy society, and we could show the rest of the world how profitable it was, how many new jobs we were creating, how many trillions of dollars we were saving, and how much damage to the United States we were avoiding. Other nations will follow the United States down that path. But if we lead them down the path of ever-increasing production of oil and coal and natural gas, they'll follow us in that direction too, and they'll call us out for our hypocrisy.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming live at WBAI.org.
This is an open letter from you and me together. Tomorrow's in our hands now.
Find the words that matter, say them out loud. I'll make it better somehow.
Looking down from up on the moon is a tiny blue.
Join my conversation with John J. Berger. If you sign up to become a member of WBAI during today's show with a contribution of $50 or more, you can receive a free copy of his book, Solving the Climate Crisis. Just go online to give to WBAI.org or call 212-209-2950 during today's show, and we'll be happy to send you a copy. That's give and the number 2WBAI.org or 212-209-2950. But don't forget to make that $50 or more donation in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large. And thank you very much. And we return now to John J. Berger, the book Solving the Climate Crisis, Frontline Reports from the Race to Save the Earth, is from Seven Stories Press. Mr. Berger is an environmental science and policy specialist, a prize-winning author and journalist. He's written and edited 11 books, including three previous books on climate change, written over 100 articles on climate change and transitioning to clean energy. And he's co-founded the Nuclear Information and Resource Service to assist citizen safe energy groups. And he founded Restoring the Earth to bring environmental restoration to national attention. On top of that, you've written this book. Wow. You've been very busy.
I plead guilty as charged to that charge.
We mentioned earlier the United Nations Climate Change Conference. We've been talking a lot about the impact of the U.S. Have other countries responded, or does it vary? I mean, you mentioned that China is a major polluter. Are some countries really cutting back, and should we be watching what they're doing?
Yes. For example, the Scandinavian countries and the EU countries have been doing exemplary work. And I write in my book about Copenhagen and how Copenhagen has gotten pretty close to becoming a net carbon zero society. They were hoping that they could do that by 2024 or 2025, it looks like. It's going to take them a few more years, but whereas in the United States, each citizen generates on the average about 14 tons of CO2 per year, in the Scandinavian countries and elsewhere in the world, it is much, much lower. I can't reel off the figures from memory precisely now, but it would be more like, let's say, 4 tons of CO2, or even, I think in Copenhagen, actually, it is probably down to about 1.5 or 2 tons, but I could be wrong, and I'm just basically guessing a bit here. Suffice it to say, most of the rest of the world emits very, very low amounts of CO2 per capita. So we are the world's, certainly one of the very most egregious offenders in terms of the amount of CO2 that we are emitting per capita. But other nations have adopted national climate plans, and they are transforming their transportation sector much more rapidly, and their industrial sector, and they're relying more on clean energy. And for example, in Copenhagen, you can go everywhere by bicycle safely. They have essentially got the whole city networked. So everybody is within, I don't know, half a mile of a public transit
station. So people have bought into this, making personal decisions like riding a bike or recycling or cutting back on the use of plastics? Can that have much of an impact, really?
Well, let me say that you use the phrase people have bought into it, and that's quite true, because in Copenhagen they've demonstrated that for every dollar that you spend, you get multiples, high multiples in economic return for that spending. So in terms of can people make a difference, if that's the second portion of your question, the answer is people can definitely make a difference, but I have to put that in perspective. The climate crisis is a systemic crisis. It's a societal crisis, and it requires a systemic societal solution. The individual has only so much limited scope for personal action and for organizing. And I can talk a little bit later about what individuals can do, but you're asking me about so many things all at once, I don't even know quite where to begin. It's plastic pollution, and can individuals make a difference? And the key point about individual action is that when you're making a major decision, like you're buying a home or a home heating or cooling system or a vehicle or a major appliance, a refrigerator, a dishwasher, a dryer, a washing machine, that's when you really need to look carefully at the carbon footprint of all of those purchases. And if everybody does that and we aggregate those savings, then we make a difference societally. But and we could also, let's say, eat a little bit less meat, maybe eat meat a little bit less frequently, change the diet a little bit. That shouldn't put anybody to great hardship. But these individual choices are not going to make the critical difference. This has to be a planned societal and well-funded transition, and it has been blocked so far by the intervention of the fossil fuel industry and their very wealthy dark money allies.
Well, we can design new buildings to be more energy efficient, but what about older buildings? How much can we address those?
We can address those very effectively, and there are some financial hurdles that have to be overcome. They're known as perverse incentives, because a lot of people are renters and they don't have an incentive to be changing the physical characteristics of their home. But if you study these incentives, there are programs like the Metered Energy Efficiency Transaction Structure, which was pioneered by Rob Harman in Seattle. And it shows how making investments in the older buildings can be financially extremely profitable if you adopt this transaction structure, which treats saved energy as currency, really, or value. And it's given a value, and the value is apportioned to the building owner and to the tenant and to the financer. It's complicated. I'm not going to go into it. Anybody wants details about that particular transaction structure, which could be adopted very widely and could really facilitate the renovation of the U.S. housing stock, you can find all the details about that in Solving the Climate Crisis.
It's a thick book.
But practically, I'm sorry.
It's a thick book, so there's a lot here. Over 400 pages of text.
Maybe there's probably too much, and it's probably too thick. And I apologize to my readers.
No, it's okay.
But you asked a question about what can be done, and in older buildings, it's simple. You can make the building envelope more energy efficient. You have the possibility of putting in energy efficient windows, improving the insulation, changing out and modernizing the heating and cooling system, improving the appliances, and all of the, and adding solar power to the roof, if that's possible in the location, given whatever constraints there might be on that particular site. So these are all things that can be done to the older buildings. And the beauty of it is that it creates potentially good paying local jobs that can't be outsourced, and stimulates the economy and helps people pay their bills and support their families and so forth.
And you mentioned the National Climate Plan and suggest innovations like clean steel, green cement, carbon reuse. Can you explain what they are?
Sure. Well, currently, steel is made with a blast furnace and an oxygen furnace. These are very high temperature furnaces, and they're fueled with coal. And coke is used. That's a derivative of coal. So we produce a great deal of carbon dioxide, almost 2 tons of carbon dioxide for every ton of steel that's manufactured. And the cement industry also produces a great deal of CO2. Together, cement and steel account for 17% of all of our energy greenhouse gas emissions. But there is a way around that, and it's not only workable, but it's highly cost effective. But it just needs funding to get over the first cost hurdle. To give you an example, instead of this huge blast furnace operating at 1500 degrees centigrade, it's as tall as a building and a white hot furnace, you can now use cleanly generated electricity from solar and wind and hydro, and you can electrolyze the steel without combustion, just melt the iron ore and separate it into molten iron, and then process it from there. Tremendous savings in capital, and also savings in terms of avoided greenhouse gas emissions.
Isn't protecting the climate potentially the greatest economic opportunity of our time?
It certainly is, for reasons that...
So why is there political opposition?
I think that this has become a kind of a litmus test or a cultural issue. It's been used as a political wedge to divide people and fragment the electorate for political gain. But there's no economic reason. In fact, the weight of the evidence economically is in favor of this. And that's why you're seeing in many red states, they are now producing large amounts of wind and solar power and understanding the benefits of these technologies. Many of the new factories that are funded by the Inflation Reduction Act, and that's hundreds of factories, are going to be in red states. A lot of the infrastructure created by the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act will also be going into red states. So it is the greatest economic opportunity, but we're only funding it at a fraction of the level that it ought to be funded. This has been mischaracterized by the fossil fuel industry as a cost. This is an investment, but it is the best investment that the United States of America and all its states and localities could possibly make, because of the tremendous avoided damages, avoided costs, and payback.
So short-term
energy savings.
Short-term costs, but long-term savings. And
precisely. We didn't even get to talk about cement and the fact that you can now make cement that produces less CO2, and that when it cures, gobbles up CO2 from the atmosphere and locks it away in a permanent storage in the chemical bonds of the cement. So we don't have to be generating 8% of our emissions from cement production. If we invest to replace the legacy cement production infrastructure with clean production infrastructure, we can avoid these tremendous amounts of emissions. I write about a small company see, originally it was in New Jersey, but now has moved to San Antonio, called Solidia Technologies. And they reformulated cement so that even though they still use a kiln, it cures and removes CO2 from the atmosphere in the curing process. And within the kiln, less CO2 is generated. But there are other companies now that have new chemical formulations that do not release CO2 when the cement is cured. And they use different compounds, and they don't have to do it at high temperatures. Some of the technologies use bacteria to create concrete-like structures that meet all kinds of industrial strength and durability tests. So I'm saying we have the technology, but we need to scale it up, and we need to provide loans so that companies can transform themselves and avail themselves of this new technology.
Alas, we have pretty much run out of time. I did want to mention that your book has an introduction by former Senator Russ Feingold. You want to comment on that in about the next minute and a half or so?
Well, I think that Russ is very concerned about protecting democracy in the United States. And we must protect our democracy if we want to protect our climate. If we lose our democracy, we will lose the ability to protect the climate. And although I mentioned that individuals personally can't save the climate by themselves, by organizing and mobilizing and making sure that our political leadership is attuned to the need for maximum full speed ahead clean energy diffusion and development, that's how we can protect our democracy. Because the very same people who are heedless of the need to protect the environment and the climate and are subservient to big business are also of an authoritarian or totalitarian state of mind. And so these two issues are linked, and it's vital for the protection of the environment and the protection of democracy that we ensure people who occupy positions of public trust and responsibility in our government.
We have to leave it there, unfortunately. We've run out of time. But I want to thank you so much for being on our show. My guest has been John J. Berger. His latest book, Solving the Climate Crisis, Frontline Reports from the Race to Save the Earth, from Seven Stories Press. Thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much, Leonard.
And that does bring us to the end of our show. If you're just discovering this program and would like to hear more about one-hour deep dive interviews, you can access them streaming on demand at WBAI.org. If you'd like to write to me, my email address is leonardlopate@WBAI.org. Before I sign off today, I need to ask you to support WBAI to aid it in surviving a serious financial crisis. We're asking all of our listeners who have the means to do so to make a contribution at whatever level they're comfortable with by calling 212-209-2950, by going online to give to WBAI.org right now. That's 212-209-2950, or give and the number 2, WBAI.org, because we need your help to keep bringing you this unique in-depth content, information you usually don't get anywhere else. And as I mentioned earlier, anyone who makes a contribution of $50 or more in the name of Leonard Lopate at large right now can receive a copy of the book we've been discussing, Solving the Climate Crisis by John J. Berger. So why not make that call right now? 212-209-2950. Go online to give to WBAI.org, because BAI relies 100% on listener donations. We don't take ads or foundation grants, and that allows us to be completely free speech radio. Again, the number to call if the station and the show are part of your daily routine is 212-209-2950, or go online to give to WBAI.org. Help support independent radio, and don't forget to make that tax-deductible contribution in the name of London Low Paid at Large. From all of us at the station, thank you very much, and I hope you can join us again tomorrow when Pete Murawski will be taking your calls about gardening and related matters that involve the environment. We'll see you then.
The United Nations Office of Human Rights condemned the mass graves unearthed in Gaza at the Al Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis weeks after Israeli forces staged a total takeover and siege of the hospital, then left. 283 bodies so far have been unearthed in the mass graves, with reports of extrajudicial executions, including medical staff and children found with their arms bound, medics with bullet holes in their head in what could be a war crime. Ravina Samdasani is a spokesperson for the UN Office of High Commissioner for Human Rights.
We are horrified also by the destruction of Al-Nasser Medical Complex and Al-Shifa Medical Complex, and the reports of the discovery of mass graves in and around facilities. And we call for independent, effective, transparent investigations into the deaths. Given the prevailing climate of impunity, this should include international investigators. Hospitals are entitled to very special protection under international humanitarian law. And let's be clear, the intentional killing of civilians, detainees, and others who are hors de combat is a war crime.
Mass graves were also unearthed earlier this month near Al-Shifa Hospital in the north, where hundreds of bodies were found. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is preparing to invade Gaza's southern city of Rafah in the coming weeks, the UK's Independent is reporting in May. The AP is reporting satellite images show a new compound of tents being built near Khan Yunis in the southern Gaza Strip ahead of the Rafah invasion to evacuate some 1.3 million Palestinians in Rafah 2. U.S. State Department spokesman Matthew Miller spoke critically of any such plan Monday.
We don't want to see Palestinians evacuated from Rafah unless it is to return to their homes. And we have made that quite clear to the government of Israel that we don't think there's any effective way to evacuate 1.4 million Palestinians. There's no way to conduct an operation in Rafah that would not lead to inordinate civilian harm and would severely hamper the delivery of humanitarian assistance. And that's the point that we continue to make to them.
Israel says Rafah is the last Hamas stronghold as its war in Gaza rages on now in its seventh month. Student activism against the war in Gaza spreading. 150 students, activists, and faculty were arrested last night at Columbia as faculty joined students defying the school's peace encampment sweep. 45 were arrested at Yale University. Anti-war encampments are also happening at three Boston universities, Tufts, Emerson, and MIT. Also at Rutgers, Penn, Harvard, New School, Vanderbilt, University of North Carolina, New York University. An encampment is also up at the University of Michigan, University of Ohio, California Poly Humboldt, and University of California Berkeley. The Supreme Court heard arguments whether a law that bars homeless people from sleeping outdoors violates the Constitution's ban on cruel and unusual punishment Monday. Christopher Martinez has more.
Lawyer Kelsey Corcoran argued for the respondents challenging the new law.
Although the city describes its ordinances as punishing camping on public property, it defines campsite as any place a homeless person is while covered with a blanket. The city interprets and applies the ordinances to permit non-homeless people to rest on blankets in public parks, while a homeless person who does the same thing breaks the law.
Chief Justice John Roberts challenged her on that point.
Violating this ordinance means upon being asked to leave, you don't leave.
Violating this ordinance means you're homeless. So again, homelessness is not something you can that you do. It's just something that you are.
Justice Sonia Sotomayor wondered about the alternative.
Where do we put them if every city, every village, every town lacks compassion and passes a law identical to this? Where are they supposed to sleep? Are they supposed to kill themselves not sleeping?
I'm Christopher Martinez.
The Supreme Court is set to hear oral arguments in a case filed by Starbucks against the National Labor Relations Board. It stems from Starbucks' firing of 7 workers who were trying to unionize their store in Memphis, Tennessee. The labor board asked a court to intervene and rehired the workers. Starbucks wants a Supreme Court to curb the board's power in those cases. Workers at 420 company-owned U.S. Starbucks stores have voted to unionize since late 2021. But none of them have secured a labor agreement with the company.